and Prabhupada going to Mexico City. And one of the things that happened when he arrived in Mexico City was there was one of his one of the older devotees. He was a sannyasi, and he had left the sannyasi ashram. He had fallen from his sannyasi position, and he was married. And now, by the time Prabhupada arrived there in 1975, he was already married and he had a son. But he hadn't seen Prabhupada since he was a sannyasi. And he just felt, as within the society, he was feeling very guilty and a lot of shame and embarrassment. And when Prabhupada was there, he didn't even want to see Srila Prabhupada because he was just so ashamed. And then, of course, Prabhupada called to see him. And he came in, and he was, yes, he was Spanish, I don't know if he was Mexican, he was definitely Spanish. And he came and saw Srila Prabhupada, and he was very, head down, he was very humble. And he said, Prabhupada, he said, you know, will you still accept me as your disciple? You know, can I still render service? And Prabhupada looked at him and he said, yes, of course. And he said, Lord Chaitanya, he said, he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He said, he could even make the animals chant and dance. When he went through Jarakanda Forest, he said, even he could make the animals chant and dance. He said, but I'm not Lord Chaitanya. He said, I need all the help I can get. So he said, just continue. He said, do your devotional service. And he did this a few times and he pointed to me. He said, now, he said, as a grahasta, he said, just like Shruta Kirti, he said, just do your service. He said, and don't, you know, don't be in anxiety, don't worry. He said, chant Hare Krishna, be happy and do your service. So Prabhupada never rejected, you know, he never rejected us. Someone asked the other day, what did Prabhupada get upset about? And one thing he got upset about, that actually really upset him, was when someone would change, make changes to that absolute truth that he was giving, when someone tried to change the philosophy, which his disciples would do these things as well. So then he would become, that was just, and even then, if they would stop, Prabhupada would forgive them. But he was filled with forgiveness. There was one of his devotees, one of the senior devotees, he on different occasions, he took the society's money to try to set up businesses to make money for Krishna. You know, we have this always thing. So, but he took tens of thousands of dollars at different times, and he never was successful. So all this money he took to do something, it would just go away. And his devotees, godbrothers, they were, after the second time this big thing happened, they became really upset and they wanted Srila Prabhupada because again he was doing the same thing. And they said, Prabhupada, you have to stop him. And Prabhupada just sat and listened and he said, Prabhupada, he's wasting all of your money and he's, you know, whatever he does, he just loses it. He's not accomplishing anything and businesses aren't successful. And you have to stop him. And Prabhupada just listened and then he said, and the devotee said, Prabhupada, he said, three times he's done this already. He said, how many times are you going to forgive him? And Prabhupada said, Vaishnava never stops forgiving. He said, as long as one has remorse, because we never stop forgiving. So that was, you know, just so amazing to hear, to see Prabhupada, the level of his loyalty to his disciples, and how forgiveness is always there. He saw that we had, especially as Westerners, we have our weaknesses, and he accepted them, but he just saw what we did to help him. That was his focus. And that's, you know, that should be our focus as we go along, you know, in our years in Krishna consciousness, is we have to see what one another, what we do, what's positive. So Prabhupada always fanned that, like the flame, he fanned that flame of what made us enthusiastic. Yes?
I've always wondered,
He gave us initiation, of course, he would always say, chant 16 rounds, and he would want to see that we were doing that, but he didn't, I never told him how many rounds to chant, so I'm not sure how many he was chanting. He chanted, I saw him chanting all through the day, you know, from early morning, even to when, sometimes when I was giving him massage in the evening, I was describing massaging Prabhupada in the evening, 9, 10 o'clock, and sometimes he would sit up in the bed and he would be chanting on his japa beads and he was pulling down counter beads. But I'm not sure how many he was doing. You know, I've heard like in the Gaudiya Mat, even Prabhupada said that the preachers, of course, that were going out, they were doing 16 rounds, and those just sitting back in the temple, the prescription, 64 rounds. I never asked Prabhupada about these things at all. One time I walked into Prabhupada's room, he rang his bell, and this was also in New Dwarka in Los Angeles, and it was in the afternoon, and Prabhupada was sitting at his desk, just like the sun was coming in the window, just like here. And I went in, and I offered obeisances, and I sat up. And just as I was sitting up, Prabhupada, he had his hand in his bead bag, and he pulled down like that. And he looked at me, and he smiled. He said, "There," he said, "I have finished my 16 rounds." He said, "Now I can do any damn thing I feel." That was for me. But that was just Prabhupada's sense of humor as well. But so I did see that. He definitely chanted rounds. He said many things about chanting rounds. He said, when same room. He said, when you're in an anxiety, he said, you chant very loudly on your beads. And he said, and if you're tired, he said, you can walk around and chant. So just all practical. He would give many practical things. And Prabhupada was with Krishna all the time. When Dr. Kapoor, that was his godbrother in Vrindavan, he told us that, because he was knew Prabhupada from, or much earlier, in the 60s and the 50s. He said, when Prabhupada came to Vrindavan there in the 70s, he put his ear to Prabhupada's chest, and he said, you could hear Prabhupada's heart, and he chanted Hare Krishna. He said, with every heartbeat you had Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. So Prabhupada was always absorbed in Krishna. And for us, he said, chant 16 rounds and follow the principles. He said, at the end of this life, you can go back home, back to Godhead. And it was that simple. He said, Maya can't touch you. He said, if you chant your 16 rounds and follow the principles, Maya cannot touch you. Yes.
Didn't he say that if you share, if you follow the principle and chant 16 rounds, I would personally open the back door for you to the spiritual world?
I didn't hear that one.
Something like that.
Yeah. I heard, when he was in Japan, he said, he wanted someone to stay, to open up Japan. This was way back in the 60s. And he said, whoever opens up Japan, the temple in Japan, that Lord Chaitanya would come and take them by the hand and bring them back home, back to Godhead. And Sudama Maharaj was there, and Sudama said, I'll stay. he took that right up.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sudama, he passed away some years ago, and he had been outside and way outside. When he was in San Francisco, he had become quite an outsider, you know, and fallen, and had a very difficult time, and he was also not very young.
He was a little critical.
He was critical.
Yeah, I actually was a personal friend of his, but he didn't keep in contact with any of the movies. For some reason, I was one of them, and a couple of others. But he was quite inimical towards Christian consciousness, and he had AIDS.
Okay.
And it was about.
You want this?
No.
Everyone can hear.
No, I don't like that. About 2 weeks before he was about to leave his body, he really wasn't, he was still walking around, he wasn't like at death's door at this point. And I think it was actually Tamal Krishnamaraj went to see him.
Okay.
And he convinced him, he said, look, you know, even if you don't believe in Krishna anymore, just go see the deities in LA, just go one time, you know. So very, very reluctantly he went to see the deities in LA. He went to see them, and literally after seeing them, he became so deathly sick he had to go to bed. So he had to stay in Los Angeles at the temple,
okay,
you know, and be looked after by the devotees. And that went on for 2 weeks, and every day the room was full of hundreds of devotees chanting at his bed.
Yeah.
And even his mother, I know her quite well, she came. And she told him, she said, Sudama, she said, last night I had a dream about Srila Prabhupada. And he took your hand and held your hand, you know. So his mother was telling him this. And she was saying, think about Srila Prabhupada, Sudama, think about Srila Prabhupada. And all the devotees were chanting. And he started becoming, you know, he started chanting again. And they said, when he left his body, you could feel demigods in the room, like, flowers were being showered everywhere, and it was a miracle because this man was so inimical to Krishna consciousness, and Prabhupada promised him at the time of death, watch a terrible person come, and they said definitely.
Yes.
You were present at this incident with the Gopi Father or something like that?
No, not that. I was present a little bit around different things. Yes, go on.
No, just if you could tell about
that. Oh, the Gopi Baba Club. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? The Gopi Baba Club. Yeah, that started, I guess it was in Los Angeles. Well, Prabhupada was here, and that's what they focused on. They would just find in Prabhupada's books, they would just find all the passages that had to do with Gopi Bhava, you know, Krishna and the gopis, and that's all they wanted to read and discuss. So they had this club that had formed. Well, when Prabhupada heard about it, he became outraged, you know, because he said, everything, like I mentioned the other day, he said Krishna's like a sweet ball. He said everywhere you bite, it's sweet. Mm-hmm. So he didn't like it at all that they had, from what he had given, they had decided that this was all they were going to hear about. He knew then, of course, this was not what we were ready for, listening to these topics. So this was the kind of thing Prabhupada, there were, like I say, Prabhupada could become angry with me if I forgot to do something, or, you know, and he could yell at the devotees. But in these kind of situations, you would see Prabhupada, this whole other, it was like Nrsingadev kind of anger. It was a real, and Prabhupada, he would turn reddish, and his lip would quiver. I mean, he just had all the symptoms of this. He could just burn you up just by looking at you, you know. And sometimes his knee would shake, but in that he could not tolerate these kind of things, you know, just taking what he had given him and, you know, try to change it in some way, or just like this with this club. And this has happened a few times, you know, over the years, where devotees would want to go to this higher level. Because this is not something you read. You have to, it's something that's realized. Like, saying, you were saying how when Prabhupada was sitting in his room and the sun came out, right? And what did he say?
He said, this is like Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
Krishna consciousness.
When Krishna comes, when the realization comes, it's there. You can't, it's not something that's forced. It's something that comes through your devotion, through your service, and following the instructions of your spiritual master. You can't force it. You can't be initiated, you know, into Gopi Bhava, like, you know, Prabhupada would talk about going to Radhakund and taking this initiation, you know, to understand your spiritual form. These things happen through realization. And Prabhupada said, everything, he always said, everything is there in his books, you know, to chant, to read his books, and through service, through submissive service, then one advances. So we should never become enamored by someone's idea that they can give you this fast track to Krishna, to Gopi Bhava. This has to be earned through our sincerity, you know, in service to the spiritual master. Imagine, Srila Prabhupada, everything is there for us. We have the most wonderful spiritual master that I was describing. He's the person everywhere in the world where people are chanting Hare Krishna. It's just because of him. It's because of what he did, not because of anyone else later on. He laid the groundwork for everything that's to happen now. No one can take that claim away from Prabhupada. So imagine Prabhupada's position to think that we have to go somewhere else for some realization. That just shows some foolishness at best, and at worst it shows arrogance. A person can't even know what his future is. One of his disciples in Vrindavan asked Prabhupada for permission to go to Radhakund to study under a Babaji there. And what did Prabhupada say?
He said,
you have my permission to go to hell. And he went.
We call it stepping on the spiritual master's
head. Yeah, stepping over. Yeah, it's trying to step over your guru. Yeah. Yes.
See, if no religion is bad, said Prabhupada, can you talk about this, our opinion?
No religion is bad?
Yes.
That we said, yes. I was reading about that today, and Prabhupada said there's two. There's atheism and theism. And he said anything that brings you to the theistic level of understanding God, that's good. That's not bad, that's good. There's, you know, so many different ways we get entrance. Just like Lord Buddha. Even what did Lord Buddha teach? Even he taught that there wasn't God, but he preached nonviolence. But he got people to worship him. He said, who was God? So even they were worshiping God. So he said, anything that's teaching, you know, love of God, that's good. Prabhupada didn't put down any of these things. But then you have to see what the result, if you're actually developing love of God. He said, but the real thing is this atheism. So anything that helps to destroy atheism, he said, that's good. So in that sense, every religion, if they preach that, that's good. Then you have to deal with what you're actually, if you're developing love of God. That's another thing. But in that sense, it's all good, because it all teaches love of God. But then in these processes, as time goes by, the principles of the religion get lost. Just like Christianity had very good principles. You know, as I was raised in that, and I saw it just in my childhood, from 1950 to when I became a devotee, 1970, so many changes went on in the Catholic Church, so many of their principles, they would change. Why? To keep that congregation coming in, you know. They would have at least a principle, don't eat meat on Fridays, but they had no philosophy behind it, and of course that went down. You know, instead of having to go to church every Sunday, they reduced it to once a year, go to confession once, everything to keep the masses coming, to keep money coming in. So they changed their principles. So Prabhupada said Christianity, of course Jesus, he said, was pure devotee. You know, he said, but who's following, you know, Jesus' instructions?
Can you say something about the influence which Prabhupada and the Krishna movement had? I mean, it's fantastic that people chanting all over the world, but also I have a feeling that there have been an influence also on so many levels. Also the alternative living today, we see people are vegetarians, and I mean, I don't know, I have a feeling that Prabhupada opened up all that thing from the start.
Oh, absolutely. And many of those things have even passed us by in our ISKCON society. They say in America, 1 out of 3 people practice yoga. 1 out of 3 people practice some form of yoga in America now. And of course, we were right at the forefront of all of these things. And now we're also, we do that in these reach out programs and all. We have different yoga groups and all. Everyone is looking for relief. And I mean, I have no idea how deep it goes with different things in society, like you say, vegetarianism. How many every week?
Every week in England, 200 become vegetarian.
200?
A week.
Yeah, every week.
Yeah. They say by the year 2012, if it continues, the whole country would be vegetarian.
But, so yeah, vegetarianism, so many of these alternative lifestyles, and these are all, yeah, these are all like sub-branches that have happened through, definitely through Krishna consciousness and the chanting of the holy name going on,
Ayurveda
going on
also
everywhere. Ayurveda is
very big.
So yeah, in so many ways. And these are all nice. Like Ayurveda is a really good avenue. You can bring people to Krishna consciousness through Ayurveda as well. She studied that. She was studying Ayurveda 25 years ago. Of course, she, you know. Now, everyone else is studying Ayurveda, right?
Yeah,
Now you should.
I could be making a lot of money.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's very popular everywhere.
You've just mentioned that Srila Prabhupada has said that actually everything is in his books. This book, most of the devotees definitely know. But I once talked to Indra Prabhu in Vrindavan, and he said, Srila Prabhupada also mentioned many other scriptures which should be translated by his disciples in the future. So is there any other instruction given of how, in which way we should study these other scriptures which are given to us later, which Srila Prabhupada, due to time lag, like, could not translate?
Different Vedic literature,
yeah.
Vaishnava scriptures. The same way we study his books. Of course, his books, again, are the basis for everything. And one can spend many years studying. Once Prabhupada said to me, I forget, it was in Australia, he was saying how many verses there were, like in Srimad Bhagavatam. How many verses in Srimad Bhagavatam?
18,000.
He said to me, so he said, how long does it take to understand one verse? So if you want to give, you know, you could say you could read a verse a day, if you wanted to really, you know, even that's, I was ridiculous, you know, I gave something about hours or something. So he said, okay, so give it once a day. If you have 18,000 verses in Bhagavatam, how many years is that? But, you know, just like Bhagavad-gita, it's wonderful, wonderful literatures which are there. But I'm very partial to Prabhupada's books.
Yeah.
I could tell you, okay, I haven't told this story yet, so I'll tell this story. Someone was asking me about Prabhupada reading his books. I was saying, you know, I was a servant for a long time. And so many times I would go into Prabhupada's room and he would be reading his books. Now there weren't many books then. There was Nectar of Devotion, Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. There was no Chaitanya Charitamrita. There was Krishna book and Bhagavad Gita. And the first canto and the first two cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. So I would sometimes, you know, I would be in and out of Prabhupada's room and he would be sitting behind his desk and he would just be reading his books, just like We would see you reading his book. Like, he was relishing in reading his books. So I came in the first time. I was a servant for a few months, and he was reading. And I offered obeisances, and he just looked up at me. And he was reading Nectar of Devotion. And he said, if you just read this one book, he said, you can become Krishna conscious. He said, you don't have to read hundreds of books. He said, just this book. He said, if you read it and understand, my problem was really surcharged reading, you know. He said, just this book. He said, if you read it and you understand, he said, you can become Krishna conscious. Yeah, I just said, yes, Prabhupada. And they offered the obeisances and left, and Prabhupada just read. So some months went by, and we're in another city somewhere, and Prabhupada's sitting behind his desk, and he's reading Bhagavad Gita. So I came into the room, and I offered obeisances, and he looked up. He had his glasses on, actually, and he looked up at me. And before I could move, he said, this book is so nice. He said, if you just read this book, he said, you can become Krishna conscious. He said, you don't have to read so many books. You don't have to read dozens and dozens of books. He said, this book is so nice. If you just read this one book, he said, you can be Krishna conscious. Yes, Prabhupada. And I wasn't reading very many books. I was never very good at reading. So I went about my service and left, and months and months go by, and I see Prabhupada reading, you know, often. But so many months went by, and again, I wound up right in front of Srila Prabhupada, and he's reading Krishna book. And I offered obeisances, and as soon as I sat up, he looked at me. He said, this Krishna book is so nice, he said. Prabhupada was in ecstasy, you know. He said, it's so nice. He said, if you just read this one book, every time it was a different one book, but he said, if you just read this one book, he said, you can be Krishna conscious. That's a Prabhupada. But he wasn't letting me leave, he was just looking at me, and he was focused, and he said, so nice, and then he looked, and he said, you don't even have to read the whole book. He said, just one chapter. He said, if you read just one chapter, he said, it's so nice. If you just read and understand one chapter, he said, you can be Krishna conscious. Yes, Prabhupada. And he's still looking at me, and I'm afraid to move. And he looked, and he said, you don't even have to read the whole chapter. He said, just this page. If you just read one page, he said, you can become Krishna conscious. And he was very serious, you know. He was very serious. And he said, yes, Prabhupada. And he just looked. He said, you don't even have to read the whole page. He said, just one line. You just read one line. He said, you can become Krishna conscious. And then he looked. He said, just one word. He said, one word. He said, if you read one word in this book, you can become Krishna conscious. He said, because Krishna is in every word. So this was what Prabhupada gave us. There's so many books. Some of you say 80 books, 60 books, 80 books, whatever it is. He spent so much time translating all of these books. And they were translated by Srila Prabhupada. So these books are very special. Well, these literatures, I'm sure they're wonderful. They're done by all great pure devotee Vaishnavas. But Prabhupada took all of this and he digested it all. And then he gave it back to us, you know, with his sweetness and his understanding of who we are, you know. And what was required. What he did was just so special. And that's why he, you know, wanted these books. He said, even if they touched one of these books, people would benefit. in temples, many temples you go to now, they have his books on the altar. They'll have a set of Bhagavatams right next to the deities, a lot of Prabhupada's books. Mm-hmm. Because it's Krishna. Mm-hmm. It's coming, imagine, it's coming directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead through Srila Prabhupada. To hold the cyclic session and then through Srila Prabhupada, who's added his flavor, mm-hmm. his devotion to it. So these are very wonderful books. Yeah. And if you just pick one up and just read one page. So imagine if you read every day one page and start your day by reading one page from one of Prabhupada's books. Like Tathagata was saying, you know, every time you read it, you know, if you read it with trying to want to become purified, it do so much. You know, just for, they're there for our purification, to help us in our Krishna consciousness. So I'm very partial to Prabhupada's books because I still haven't completed his books. Mm-hmm. And he kept telling me, just read one book. Mm-hmm. One time he said to me, when he was doing Chaitanya Charitamrita, and that was also in New Dwarka, and he said, you should become very expert, he said, in Chaitanya Charitamrita. He said, and then you give classes on Chaitanya Charitamrita. So that was one instruction Prabhupada gave me that ever took me outside of my personal service to him. You know, he said to do that. So now I look at the task and I think, well, this was quite an order. But it was an order from Srila Prabhupada. So with the spiritual master's order comes the ability, yeah, to fulfill it. Yes?
A lot of times devotees ask, you know, like, they don't feel fired up all the time, and how one can feel, you know, enthusiastic and fired up. And I was thinking about the story of the airport. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell that.
Okay. Okay. Would you like that? Would that be okay? Okay. So this was, again, I was with Prabhupada for a long time, 2.5 years. And within that 2.5 year times, I had my highs and my lows as well in devotional service and, like you say, being fired up. And even being with Srila Prabhupada, a pure devotee, it was possible not to be so fired up sometimes because we weren't pure. So, by now I had been with Prabhupada about a year, and for some reason, because I wasn't focused very well, I became really just bewildered. I was just in Maya, and I wasn't happy, and because I wasn't happy in Krishna consciousness, I let Maya take over, and I became really depressed, and I just was struggling. So what happened was, Prabhupada was flying into Los Angeles. I'm not quite sure where it was. But whenever Prabhupada arrived at a temple, it was the most amazing. Of all the different scenarios that were ecstatic, the most ecstasy was right at the airport when Prabhupada would come out through that little hallway from the plane, you know, when he would come out from the airplane into the gate area, because inside the gate there would be dozens, usually hundreds of devotees that, as I said, they hadn't seen Prabhupada for months or weeks, or maybe they had never seen him before. This was going to be their first time that they got to see Srila Prabhupada. So the ecstasy of that feeling of just Prabhupada coming was really an amazing thing. Now, I was in a funny position because I never saw Prabhupada arrive at the airport. I arrived at dozens and dozens of airports, but I was always right behind him when Prabhupada arrived. So, and before that, I just was never at an airport event. So I never got to see Prabhupada coming and have that anticipation of Prabhupada arriving. And Prabhupada also had an anticipation of seeing his disciples. And in the airplane, you would see that in Srila Prabhupada because, as I said, airplanes were a lot of fun with Prabhupada because he just carried on, you know, in his way, his transcendental way. So as soon as, like, the airplane was descending, and maybe they would put on a fasten your seatbelt sign. And as soon as they did that, Prabhupada would get up. That was, for him, that meant get up and go to the bathroom and put tilak on. So that meant I also had to get up, because where Prabhupada went, I went with him, so I would walk him back to the bathroom. So the bing, that light would go on. And I would always get filled with anxiety because, you know, people would look at me and say, you have to tell him to sit down. And then I'd just say, you know, I can't tell him anything, you tell him. And then no one would ever say anything to him. And Prabhupada, he would just act completely aloof from the whole situation. One time as we were walking back, and he just looked at me and he laughed. He said, when you're an old man, you can do anything you want. So, and that's what he would do, anything he wanted. And people would say something, he would just, like, he didn't even understand English. He'd just keep walking. And I'd follow behind him. So then he would go in, and I would stand outside the door, and the plane's going like this. And so he'd go to the bathroom, and then he would put on fresh tilak, because he was going to see all the devotees. And then the plane would land, and Prabhupada would, he would sit up, and he would fix his kurta, and he would fix his bead bag, hang his bead bag on his neck very nicely, and he would fix his sash, his sannyas cape, and then he would say, get the garlands, because there were always garlands when Prabhupada left and when Prabhupada arrived, and those beautiful flower garlands, you can imagine, right? Fragrant, the whole plane would smell sometimes of gardenias that were in Prabhupada's garlands, like 50, 100 gardenias and roses, and so I'd get the garlands, and Prabhupada would pick the one he wanted, you know. And then put the garland around Prabhupada, and he'd say, now you take. So then the other garlands we would all put on, because we were going to go out and see the devotees, and Prabhupada wanted everyone to look really wonderful. So the plane would land, and as soon as the plane would land and they would open the door, you could hear kirtan. Mm-hmm. Because in those days, everyone could come to the gate. So they would be at the gate. And in Los Angeles, there would be hundreds of devotees, and maybe 10 mirdangas, you know, and 20 sets of kartels and gongs. So all this kirtan's going on in the LA airport, and you could hear it. And then, just as, of course, the plane was landing, now that anticipation is just getting greater and greater, you know. The devotees are going to see Prabhupada. They hadn't seen him for however long, it didn't matter. They just wanted to see Prabhupada. And then, you know, people would start walking out. And Prabhupada was never in first class. He was always in the coach. And so people would start walking. And as people started walking out, you could hear the kirtan growing. Because now they know, you know, it's just a matter of minutes. And people are walking and... And row by row, you know, that horrible thing, you have to wait for everybody in front of you to go out. And then Prabhupada, he'd never just walk behind someone. There was always some space. You know, Prabhupada left space between himself and the rest of the world. So there would be some space. So whenever there were spaces, the devotees are thinking maybe Prabhupada's the next person, you know. So, and then finally, Prabhupada would walk into the airport. And you can just imagine Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada's clothes looked like they were electric or something, you know. It was just that effulgence was there. And Prabhupada's face was effulgent. And it's just simultaneously exhibited so many different emotions. When you saw Prabhupada's face, there was this look of humility was there, and he had this regal look that was there, and then he had that same feeling. He was just happy to see his disciples. He was smiling because as he was coming out, and he would see hundreds of devotees in all bright colors, saffron and white and bright saris, and everyone by now is just jumping up and down, you know. People are falling on the floor offering dandavats, and people are crying and laughing. And Prabhupada was just, for Prabhupada, it was just wonderful. And so he would just walk out, and I was right behind him. So everybody was in ecstasy.
except for me. I'm right behind Prabhupada, and I didn't feel anything at all. All I felt was, I was in complete Maya, and I just felt sorry for myself that I didn't feel ecstasy like all of my God brothers and God sisters. And here I am with people, I'm just with Prabhupada, I'm right behind them. And I see everyone, and they're all going crazy. And the more I saw, the worse I felt. So I'm just doing my service, and I have Prabhupada's white bag in one hand, and, you know, and something else in another hand. And Prabhupada goes off, and all the devotees, you know, are following behind him and banging the drums with one hand and jumping up and down in the air. And I'm just walking next to Prabhupada. So we get back to the temple in New Dwarka. And now Prabhupada goes up to his room. It's like 11 o'clock in the morning. So immediately I have so many things I have to do. And put Prabhupada's suitcase away and get his desk ready, take everything out from the white bag. And immediately I had to start his lunch in the cooker. So I'm, you know, cutting the vegetables and fill up the cooker and make a chapati dough. And then I went and gave Srila Prabhupada a massage. And I'm still feeling really bad. And I said I never asked Prabhupada so many things. But I was massaging him. And I was just, I don't know, I was just feeling so bad. And while I'm massaging his back, I said, Prabhupada, I said, all your disciples, they have so much love for you. I said, and when they see you, they go into ecstasy. I said, they all love you so much, and they feel so much happiness. And I said, I don't feel anything. And I'm rubbing his back as I'm saying this to him, and I just completely exposed what a nonsense I was, you know. And Prabhupada didn't say one word. He just sat there, and I gave him a massage. So I went from his back, and then I went to his side, and I'm rubbing, and the whole time Prabhupada just sat quietly. He didn't respond to my question, statement, whatever it was, my feelings. He didn't say anything. And in fact, the more I looked at him, the more I thought, like, oh, he's not very happy with me at this moment. And just looked, and I saw that he looked so grave, you know, just sitting and I'm massaging and I'm rubbing his legs and massaging his feet. I have the greatest service in the world. I'm doing all these things, you know. And he didn't say a word. So finished the massage. I put a little oil in his hand and he would put it in his ears and his nostrils and oil all his gates. And he just went off with his gumcha on. I would see his legs and he just went off. So now I had, this was the busiest time of the day for me. So I ran back into my room and I turned off the cooker and chaunced all the vegetables in the dal. And I had to roll chapatis. I rolled a few chapatis and got his bowls ready. I had already put his clothes out on his bed. So Prabhupada's getting dressed. He's saying Gayatri and I'm getting his lunch ready. So then I come in with his lunch plate, and usually it was just in time. Prabhupada's just finishing his Gayatri mantra, and bam, his lunch is there, rice, chapatis, dal, sabji. And I put his tray down, and I ran back out of the room and roll another chapati and heat it up, puffs up, and ran back in. So you do that four or five times, bring him hot chapatis. And he's not saying one word, not one word. Every time I go in, I offer obeisances, I run back out. And I'm kind of engaged in service now, so there's some relief because I'm doing some service. So then Prabhupada was finished and I went and I got the plates and I go back outside and I transfer everything to other plates and I wash his plates and put them away and then I go distribute prasadam. And Prabhupada took a nap. And then another half hour or so goes by and then the bell rings. So I went into Prabhupada's room, and now I'm kind of not thinking of anything. And I went into Prabhupada's room, and I offered obeisances, and I sat up. And Prabhupada looked at me, and he said, do you like your service? I said, oh yes, Prabhupada, very much. He said, that's love. He said, service is love. He said, they may be jumping up and down. He said, that's very nice. He said, but love is service. He said, so you just keep doing your service, he said. Everything will be all right. And he smiled. So then I smiled. I said, thank you, Prabhupada. I had waited so long to hear something, you know. And then he said, so I was so happy. And I just called for the obeisances. And everyone says, what a nonsense I was, you know. So that's our business, is service. Service to Srila Prabhupada, service to our spiritual master. That's how we show our love for Prabhupada, for Krishna, by doing service. Prabhupada would always say, when you love someone, right, you're always thinking about them, you want to do things for them, you want to cook for them, you want to take them places. There's signs of love. So he said, just do your service. Yeah, I was so happy because I never wanted to bother Prabhupada. He had so many things to deal with. I didn't want to be one of those added difficulties. Yes?
I was thinking, Guru, because now there's so many books about Gayatri Mantra. One of the things is, for instance, it's mentioned you cannot chant Gayatri while traveling, driving in a car or in the airplane for that reason. So what did Srila Prabhupada do? Did he emphasize the time, this specific time every day, or was it when he was back from traveling?
I always saw him do it right before he went on the morning walk, which was right around sunrise, just before sunrise. And then he would do it just before lunch, which that would be somewhere around 12:30, 1 o'clock. In the afternoon one, evening one, I'm not sure when that was going on. But I'm as close as possible to, you know, where the proper times were good. And, but that was, yeah, there are, I've seen the book, like you said, like the book is a very nice book. I was reading it. It's really very helpful. You know, these things are good to know and understand. But as far as I can't remember, even if he did it on airplanes at times, or if you're on a 10-hour flight, I would imagine you would have to, you know, better to do it, right? So, yeah. Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Which canto?
Seventh
canto, Srimad
Bhagavatam.
I had never heard that. A favorite. I never heard Prabhupada say one was his favorite over everything else. He seemed to like he said, I saw him reading, you know, Bhagavad Gita, Nectar of Devotion, those things. I'm sure he liked, that is wonderful, the seventh canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is very sweet. But I don't know anything specific that he said was his favorite. Do you know any of those things? No. I almost can't even imagine him saying something like that myself. But it sounds okay. There's nothing wrong with that, having a favorite. I mean, I think of so many devotees with favorite stories about Prahlad Maharaj and Burmashinga Dev. And Prabhupada like that. I remember there was one play Prabhupada watched. I think it was in Juhu. And the young devotees, they put on a play, the young boys of Lord Nrisimhadev and Prahlad Maharaj. And Prabhupada watched the play and he enjoyed it very much. And in the beginning of it, he gave a lecture afterwards. And what did he say? We would like to thank Haranyakashipu. He said he was very good. So Prabhupada really enjoyed it. And he liked the performance. He said he wanted to thank the performance of Haranyakashipu, he said, in that particular play. So he enjoyed that. Sometimes he didn't care too much for some of the plays that were put on as well. He liked them done seriously.
Very seriously.
Yeah. He didn't like them to be done. Yeah, in a, you know, or frivolous, humorous way. He liked it to be serious. Hare Krishna.
My wife and I actually just had a talk about these dramas a few hours ago. We actually talked about that very point, what Prabhupada actually wanted for drama. So, so you say that he wanted it like serious?
Yes.
But preferred he kind of leelas, or also, you know, sometimes you make plays which are, telling like instructive point, but maybe in a context of like a Western scene or like that, or what did Prabhupada think of that?
Do you know?
Not really. I mean, they did that fish play, didn't they?
Yeah, fish out of water.
Yeah.
Probably like that.
The ones I do remember were always the very serious ones, but I can't say that doesn't mean he didn't like. I don't know what he didn't like, but I know he liked the very serious ones.
Yeah, I could say that more.
But I guess, again, in preaching,
Certainly instructive that people can understand. I mean, he would use that analogy, you know, many times and put it into a play. I don't think there's anything.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing. But he liked it done well.
Yeah.
And that whatever was done should be done in first class. That seemed to be how he saw things. Yes? One thing I think was a lot had to do with the instructions that the devotees were given at the temple level, not to disturb Prabhupada by writing letters and asking questions. It was always emphasized that Prabhupada had to concentrate on translating work, and we didn't, you know, they didn't want to distract him from that. So
I thought, I think she was asking, were you asking why he would be nervous sometimes asking questions, or anybody?
General and some
disciples were not at all nervous. In fact, some were so familiar they would sometimes even argue with Srila Prabhupada.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, it was very individual, I think. My husband, out of humility, he was.
I had certain things I thought I knew if I just kept my ears open. He would always answer my questions because everyone else was asking them all the time. So I figured I didn't need to, because I would wait for others to ask. And I never really had a lot of questions. Everything kind of from the first day I was describing it to Kabul. From the first day I went to the temple, I just accepted it as absolute truth. Everything in the philosophy, and I just didn't have that kind of mind that had to analyze everything. I don't have that kind of mind. I just accept it. And everything I saw about Prabhupada just confirmed that everything was fine, and Prabhupada was Krishna's pure devotee, and everything he said was perfect. And like he said, service, you know, that's what needed to be done, you know, nice submissive service. Prabhupada would say that, you know, all the questions, they should be asked before you accept initiation. You know, any doubts you have, everything from then. Our real goal is to serve nicely, have to chant and follow and do service. Of course, questions can come up, but it's in the beginning. You know, that's when we should be asking all our questions if we have doubts and things. Otherwise, Prabhupada wanted that we should be convinced in our devotional service that. Just carry on, just like he was, you know. I found it so nice, like when I was talking about the Shastra, how Prabhupada read it, that was it. You know, if something was there in the books, in the Bhagavatam or the Gita or any of the Vedic Shastras, there was no question of debating that truth. And that's the level we need to arrive at. And if we don't understand it, you can let it go, or you can try to figure out how it is true, but there's no question that there's something else, some other truth. So when I wanted to ask him something, I would ask him, but I just really didn't need to. I just wanted to assist him, do my service, and I was happy to do that, you know. I was happy that I did that. And I think Prabhupada appreciated that as well. He had so many people asking him so many things. He didn't need the person that in one sense was closer to him than anyone, with him 24 hours a day serving him, that'd be like a wealth of questions, you know, and difficulties, and why is this like this. And I just thought, I just enjoyed seeing Prabhupada being comfortable and being able to do the things he wanted to do. I thought that was, he said first class servant, he said just does his service without being asked, you know. So to me that meant that you were invisible. And Prabhupada would tell me to do things without even opening his mouth. In Vrindavan, Prabhupada would sit behind his desk and he would just look. And I knew it meant open the curtains or close the curtains, you know, or he'd look like that, and it meant turn on the fan, or turn off the fan, or turn on, he wouldn't say anything, he would just look around, and by his looks, I would know what he wanted to do. And to me, that was really wonderful to be so in tune with him, you know. And he liked that, and I saw from the very beginning, like I said, when I was reading Krishna book, I wasn't even his servant, and he would just look at me. He didn't say, okay, you know, Sruta Kirti, would you read Krishna book now? He'd just look at you. And bam, I was reading Krishna book. So that was like, that was just wonderful to have so connected, you know, that he could do that. So he never wasted, Prabhupada never wasted even a movement, you know, or he didn't speak just for the sake of speaking. If you've ever been around people, you say they just like to hear themselves talk. Whether someone's listening or not, they just want to talk. Prabhupada talked when he had something to say, you know. And neither did he like people to try to make him speak. He would say the spiritual master is not your, you know, not your plaything, not your toy, you know, not to just engage in some activity.
So. I was surprised how, because he was dealing with some very intense people. You know, everything wasn't perfect when he was here. There was a lot of politics, you know, going on. Pretty intense things. How tolerant he was of having to deal with these heavy characters. You know.
Yes.
Also, one can imagine, you know, of course, how long time Srila Prabhupada would use daily on answering letters. One can imagine, I guess. Because you know how long time Srila Prabhupada would use daily just on answering letters. And I think it's similar going on now.
It's worse.
Because there's so many more devotees.
So now you have the internet. Now you have the internet. People, some of my God brothers, they don't even get on anymore. Like Niranjan Swami, if you write him, you just get this message. I'm no longer reading my email. It's just like overload. And that's what we've done in society. Things are so much more complicated. It was so nice. You would write a letter to Prabhupada, and you would get a typed letter back with a signature on it. It was a beautiful, a beautiful way to communicate. And they always say it was 25 letters a day or so. It could have been more, could have been less, but it was, every day. And these letters, they would follow Prabhupada around the world. Sometimes you would send it to one place and it would get there after he left, and they would forward it to the next place. And you could, sometimes you wouldn't get a response for 2 or 3 months, on a letter, but you always got a response. Prabhupada, every letter Prabhupada responded to.
Of course, we know how very important Srila Prabhupada's time was, but maybe that is also there now.
Yeah.
Spiritual masters may be the most important persons now on earth. And many times if we are sending him there, it's not even important, we're just stealing with that time.
You have to be sensitive to them all.
Yes. Well, I see that with Maharaj a lot, you know. She tries to always break up the crowds after class so that he can just get back to his room.
It's unbelievable, you know. And I explain, if you really love him, you will be
used. In New Dwarka, Karandar, he was the GBC at the time. He was almost like the head GBC, and New Dwarka was the, you know, the world headquarters. And Prabhupada had a lot of respect for Karandar and a lot of faith in what Karandar did. But one time, I guess it was 1973, and he said to Prabhupada, he said, you know, now they have out telex machine. You know, this was way, way before computers or cell phones. Nothing existed, none of these things. And he said, Prabhupada, they have a telex. And he said, we can, for a few $100s, we can buy a telex machine. He said, and they could get one in the other temples. So like in New York would have a telex, and, you know, Delhi could have a telex, and Chicago and all the temples. And then we could have, you know, instant communication. And once you have the machine, the, you know, there was no cost or very little cost, because then phone calls were very expensive, you know, long distance phone calls were more expensive then than now. And so he said, Prabhupada, what do you think? And Prabhupada said, he said, simply they'll use it for gossip. So that's what he said when they had this big idea about using the telex, which was, you know, nothing like the computer and the internet. But you can see, what do we do when, you know, nothing but gossip, you know. No, in the name of doing service, there's just so much gossip on there. People talking about everybody, what they do and don't do. And, you know. And Prabhupada saw that back in 1973, they didn't want anything to do with it. He didn't even like the telephone. I saw him on the telephone once in 2.5 years. He would never go to the telephone. If you wanted to see him, you wrote him a letter, or you sent him a telegram. Sometimes people would fly, you know, from one place to another to see him, to ask him something. But there was no getting on the telephone. You couldn't get Prabhupada on the telephone, and he didn't like it. We don't carry a cell phone anymore. We gave it up 5 years ago. People always say, you know, give me your cell number so I can keep in touch. And we'll say, we don't have one. And they look at us like, well, how do you exist without a cell phone? I don't know, we've been doing
it.
We did most of our lives, we existed without it.
It's just an invasion. Life.
Just, it's actually all these things that make us more impersonal.
Yeah, less communicative.
You know, you see, you'll be right next to someone, you'll be with someone, and as soon as that phone rings, you just completely lose them. And they have to jump on this telephone and talk about whatever. You know, it's terrible.
No,
you hear songs playing. It's so funny, some of the songs you hear on the phone sometimes. I'd be given a class and hear some Beethoven jingle in the background or something.
And it can just be a moment of ecstasy and it just disturbs.
Destroys everything. Huh? Yes. Yes.
Wondering that you with the spiritual master and this communication, because you told me that you also, for example, talked to Radhana Maharaj about this youth preaching. And Prabhupada did get some reports sometimes from disciples. I just mean that we shouldn't disturb the spiritual master and write unnecessary topics. But Prabhupada did enjoy. Didn't he get some reports?
He liked preaching reports, yes.
Positive reports.
Yeah. Yeah, from, you know, from the from anyone, but from the leaders. He wanted reports to know what was going on, but yes, about how the preaching was going on in book distribution. He always liked those things. He didn't like to have to deal with, you know, with so many problems that were going on. He said that, you know, Prabhupada set up a system. He had a system in place and he wanted us to try to resolve things, you know, amongst amongst ourselves, you know, with our god brothers and god sisters, that it could be taken care of. Because he did only have so much time, and he did want to concentrate on his translating work. And when other things were there, then he would become, you know, his mind would just become disturbed by hearing these different reports and things.
And it is important that there is somebody you can speak to. In Chalkati there, my sister really was our counseling system. And it was a really, really good system where everybody feels taken care of. And that is very important, that everybody feels taken care of. But it can't always be, obviously, run on the
right side. Just like their Prabhupada, like when you got this letter from Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, who was Gani Shama, that he was so enthralled and...
No, I was just thinking, I asked my husband to talk about that, the Darshan Maharaj with Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj.
Yes?
Somebody asked me. Maybe we don't have time anymore.
Yeah, I was thinking of when getting a little
tired.
No.
He had to go to work tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay.
But
you want to go on?
We don't work.
Yeah. Nothing to do.
Everybody okay.
Okay. Then what do we want to spend it doing? You want to hear this about, or are there other questions, or? Yes.
Thank you for a very wonderful seminars.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, if Prabhupada had any specific view about having regular meetings. Like, for example, here in the temple we have every morning meeting. The last year we have many meetings, planning meetings for the future. Just wondering what Prabhupada's view was, or if he gave any specific instructions how it should be.
I was not a meeting person myself, so it was a little difficult for me to relate to. We used to have back in there, we called istagosti, probably say, istagostis, meetings in the temple. Certainly it has to be done, yeah. Everyone should, you know, that's part. The temple is a family, and the family, the things are always coming up, and things that need to be dealt with, but... Yes, he liked a lot of cooperation and meetings. He liked to focus on how to spread Krishna consciousness. Because if that was done, everything else kind of takes, you know, kind of evaporates when we are engaged in devotional service. But it's definitely the duty of the leaders to see that everyone is taken care of in the temples. Prabhupada would see. Sometimes Prabhupada would go out for a morning walk. It would be cold out and there would be devotees and they wouldn't even have a sweater on, you know, and they would have, you know, little shoes with no socks. And Prabhupada would look, you know, he would look into the GBC, whoever, and says, why don't they have sweatshirts? You know, why don't they have coats? Why don't they have pants? Like, he would ask, like, to him it was automatic that someone surrenders their whole life to you. They have to be taken care of, you know. And it wasn't, and we can't be thinking that Krishna is not going to provide. Krishna is providing everything. I mean, even this thing like in the temple, you know, we're all here serving the deities. And to think we have so many programs going on, but we can't supply them with nice prasadam or something or whatever it may be, you know. You have to take care of Krishna, everything else. Isn't that our philosophy? You water the root. This is the roots, Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda. And everything else will go on successfully. You know, I see that. One thing, Prabhupada, again, he emphasized the deity worship, worshipping the deities very nicely. And I think if one thing's where it's kind of over the years, in many places it seems to have gotten de-emphasized, the standard has gone down, it hasn't gone up, because it's like, well, we can't maintain it anymore, so we just come down to this very low level because we have so many other things to do. And, you know, I would dispute that way of doing things, that you have to, the deities are there, you have to take nice care of them, then other things will happen, people can come to assist. And So I don't know. It's such an important program, and you know, if they're sitting there silently, not saying anything, maybe it's because you don't realize who they are. You know, maybe they're just not talking to you. But it's very important.
He was asking about mindfulness. I could be completely wrong, but personally, I feel like way too many meetings around this one, and you know, the very basics are neglected. The, you know, we would go out in Harinam every day. We would do book distribution. You know, we'd have morning and evening class, and that seems so much time into this committee and this subcommittee and going. And I just don't think that was Prabhupada's mood, the way he did things.
With the GBC, he said they should meet for three. This was in Mayapur. He said they should meet for like 3 hours a day. And it was like for 3 days. And that was it.
Every year?
Yeah.
Once a year. So again, I'm not an authority in this kind of anything, but definitely we do. So all we do is meet. Just the program is simple. Chant. Prabhupada would say chant. Can't. We want to do everything but, you know.
I think after traveling around, some realization we had was the temples that have a living GDC seem to thrive there. You know, just like Taupati is Ramaswamy, Hungrishi Ramaraj, they're full on, you know, and if devotees there feel more, I think, protected. But now, like, we're in Australia, and you don't even really know who is the GDC there. They don't, maybe they see him once a year for a week, you know. So I can really see that fatherly figure is very, very necessary, and I think that's lacking right now.
Tell them that. We're trying to. Yeah. Prabhupada liked everything done on the local level, not through big bureaucracy. Prabhupada didn't like the idea of big centralized bureaucracy that just, you know, set up a system that everyone should just do, where no one gets to think, how can I serve Krishna? You know, he wanted everyone as individuals, how can I best serve Krishna? How can I best serve my spiritual master? He said, you don't want to smother that spirit. You know, every spirit soul has is, you know, their very life in what to do. So he wanted as individuals that we serve Krishna, and you know, and of course a cooperative spirit, society, there had to be cooperation to do things nicely. But he liked things done on local levels by, you know, within each temple, in the society, and the temple president, and management teams, and everyone in the temple to be involved, to feel like they can contribute. Yes?
Now in many places in Europe, the temples are small, devotees are less. So sometimes maybe we can notice that sometimes the feeling goes around like there may be, you know, like very few brahmacharis, a handful of brahmacharis or something, and then. When new bhaktas join, and then they're like young new devotees, you know, they can be jumping up and down, and they will be inspired, like in many cases. But then like they can be pushed, you know. Also they can be, you know, like they can, okay, you know, like okay, yes, nice, you know. But like we see that there is this need for brahmacharis. Running temples are so in places like in many countries in Europe, it's become so difficult. To just run the temples, you know, to maintain. So then, like, instead of maybe like seeing that what the person is good at or what the propensities can be, the tendency perhaps is that you know, that okay, encourage him to be a brahmachari, he will get two more hands too, you know. And then also this, like a certain gap in, brahmacharis maybe feel more protective with each other, and then, you know, communication with women, with mothers, you know, and I mean, times are difficult, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we can see that
mm-hmm.
you know, running the temple is a big responsibility.
Yeah. Was there a question in
there? No, I hear what you're saying. And again, traveling around, I see that actually there seems to be less and less women living in temples. You know, more men. I don't know why.
You know, you go to America. You know, in the West, in Europe, at the manor, some of these temples they're not even being service being done by local people. We have many people now. You see them from Eastern Europe, you know, in America, and from West Bengal. You know, you have Mayapur devotees because they're not making local devotees. I don't know any easy answers other than just as much as possible we should be. That's why I say you just really want to stick the Prabhupada's formula as much as possible without trying to make so many adjustments. And I know in a few places, like in Los Angeles, they're making bhaktas there. And what do they do there? They do book distribution and they do Harinam. And they distribute books, and they have people making devotees locally. You know, there's another place I know where it's also going on, but I can't think of where it is right now. But it seems like, you know, it's a question, you know, we have faith. Huh? Prabhupada really instilled faith in us. If you just do this, this will happen. You know, the following things are going to happen. And I think that's what it requires, is a lot of faith, and put our faith in Prabhupada's instructions and do that more and more, and concentrate on distributing Prabhupada's books and doing Harinam. And it made plenty of devotees at that time by that method. You know, there weren't any other programs. There weren't any bridge programs. That's all there was Harinam all day. Like you said, we were talking about it. We were, as far as alternative things, there was only a few thousand devotees. You know, by 1973, 1974, maybe there were 3,000 devotees in the whole world. But we were always in the news. We were in movies. In the movies in the 70s, you would always see a shot with devotees, you know, dancing down the street, right? We were in movies, we were on the television, we were in the news. Just a few thousand people making a lot of noise, you know, chanting Hare Krishna. And if you would have asked people, they probably would have thought there were millions of us. Because everywhere they went, they saw Hare Krishnas. You know, when they were traveling at the airport, they couldn't get away from Hare Krishnas. You know, when they were in downtown going to work, they had to walk by Hare Krishnas. Everything, they were seeing Hare Krishnas. So it was, you know, effective. And I guess there's a lot, I'm sure there has to be many different opinions about it and why it's not done so much anymore. Yes.
One interesting thing might be that when Srila Prabhupada was here, all devotees were practically living in the temple, living as brahmacharis and brahmacharinis, even married.
Mm-hmm.
And the children they would sell to Gurukul.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to bring that point up.
Yeah.
Because that should have been the natural progression, the children should be running the temples now. Because they're not, I mean, some of these children are 40 years old, but because we failed the children, we didn't give them the right training, the right love, the right education. You know, they haven't taken over. They actually should have taken over. They should be running our temples now. You know, Prabhupada said the children's children will be the pure devotees in this society, and I have full faith in that, that will happen.
She has a plan how to revive the children.
I work with the children a lot, you know.
yeah, I had some plans, you know, because I strongly believe in Srila Prabhupada's words on that, that they will be the ones that are pure. And I see it.
It's natural because they will do the opposite of the parents.
That's right.
Kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's deep within them. They were born with it. You know, I don't know if you know many of the children. It's very deep. You know, they're devotees. They're not going to blow.
Mm.
You know, like my son said, what am I going to blow too? What's better than this? You know? And most of them feel like that. But they're not going to do what, you know. They're just not interested in the kind of behavior that goes on. You know, they want to do it properly.
Mm.
You know. So I think, you know, we have a lot of hope, you know, for the future, actually. When children have left, it's natural all these things are going to go on. We're going to have problems and difficulties. But it'll balance out. You know, we're learning. Right now we're learning.
Can you please say more on what your son is doing?
Which one? Well, we have a son in Govardhan. Him and his wife and daughter live in Govardhan. And get up in the morning and they milk cows and chant 64 rounds. And
he's turned into a Baba. Govardhan Babaji. He's a disciple of Bir Krishna Maharaj, both of them are.
And their daughter, she cooks and she plays harmonica, she's 8.
She's 8 years old.
Chants 4 rounds and we have other children and that is advanced as that.
One wants to be a big real estate tycoon.
He's
a devotee.
He chants every morning. But he's buying a property and
he just started in London area and bought his first house. And
yeah, he studied yoga.
Very enterprising,
IV,
yeah.
He chants 4 rounds every morning before he goes to work. And also different levels. Our daughter's doing a teacher's degree in Australia. They're all devotees on different levels. I just see all the children very, very advanced, even though you may not see it. I just see it like sometimes you look at British basses and you don't understand their behavior, but you know they're very advanced. But this is how the children are, and it's going to come out. They're going to bless them one day.
Tell about this in Rishikesh.
Yeah.
I just have a plan that I'd like to open a place in Rishikesh. My husband and I go there quite a lot and actually take a motorbike and drive up to Badrinath and we would just travel around like that and have fun. But I have this idea of getting a center there and not actually a temple but a place where our children can go. And I don't know if you've been to Rishikesh, but it's the best place in India for preaching to Westerners right now. Mm. It's full of Westerners. They're all going there. They're not being given Krishna consciousness. So I feel it could be nice to have a place where the children run the center, where they teach yoga, because there's so many yoga teachers, I think, a lot of our children. Actually, my future daughter-in-law is studying Ayurveda right now. She's doing a professional Ayurveda doctor. You know, they could teach Madonna, they can teach Bharatanatyam, you know. And it can be not like a temple, but they have to follow the principles that was written. But somewhere in the middle, you know, where they're more comfortable and they don't feel judged. And they can use their propensities to spread Krishna consciousness. So
was Radhanath Maharaj said it's the best preaching in all of India.
He said it's the best place to preach.
It's an amazing place.
I actually spoke to him about it and he thought it was a wonderful idea and tried to tackle marriage also. So that's just an idea I have to work with the children up there. I have relationships with a lot of children in the school and communicate with them. I think they're amazing, the kids.
Yes?
I was thinking about how respected did Srila Prabhupada become in India? I mean, was he very famous or just slightly famous?
He's very famous now.
Yeah.
Yeah, now?
Yeah.
Yeah. But in your times.
Oh.
In his own time. Well, it was, I guess just in the later years, really from 75 on, which he was just telling outside a funny story when was one of Prabhupada's disciples had said to him, he said he was learning Hindi. He said he wanted to learn Hindi, and Prabhupada said, why? He said, well, you know, he wanted to preach to the Indians. And Prabhupada said, I've been preaching to him for 30 years. He said, I haven't made one devotee. He said, what are you going to do? And so he told him not to bother. But, you know, that's when Prabhupada came to America. Prabhupada had been preaching for so many years, you know, and telling the families, give me one son, give me one brahmachari, you have four sons, five sons. Give me one son that I can train up, you know, as a brahmachari. And even when Prabhupada was going around India, they would help. You know, many of them would help him and all. But he didn't get a lot of people that surrendered to him. He didn't get Indians that were surrendering. But they would offer him help in different ways because he was pushing, you know, Vedic culture, or what, you know, they thought maybe he was pushing Hindu culture outside of India. So they appreciated that. But, you know, so many really just, they didn't understand what Prabhupada was doing and giving Krishna consciousness to everyone. And we say, it's funny, like in Bombay at Chowpatty, I mean, there's, you know, thousands of followers there, devotees there, Vaishnavas there, and so, of course, they're all Indians, but there's no Hinduism there. Or you can even come into the West here and see in our temples where, you know, the Hindu-like, you know, they have, they're more Hindu than Vaishnava, some of them. But it's something that doesn't have to happen. Like I say, in Chowpatty, don't ever experience that. They've surrendered to Srila Prabhupada, and they see Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But it can be very difficult in India. You know, it's so many customs and ideas are ingrained in them for generations, for thousands of years, you know. And Prabhupada, even in his final months and things, he would say, let me go back to the West. You know, I want to preach. He wanted to go back to England. He wanted to go to the West and preach. He said, they don't appreciate us here in India. Sometimes he would say, they don't even appreciate it because they wouldn't give him facility. Like even in Mayapur, he wanted to acquire so much land, you know, to build this Vedic planetarium and everything. But they would always have obstacles. And Prabhupada saw that preaching in America was, you know, so easy. So now, of course, things, so much preaching is going on in India, and they have appreciation for devotees and Prabhupada, I think more so than ever. But at the time, he was known and he was appreciated, but there were always people that had something to say, you know, different propaganda, and there was, I mean, as they say, the communist propaganda, different, you know, factions and parties they didn't care for Westerners being in their country, you know, the evil Westerners. Yes.
I just read in this Prabhupada makes a good point. That's what Prabhupada said to one Indian, yes, give advice, it was back to Godhead. Prabhupada said, we can distribute back to Godhead in English in India. And this Indian gentleman said, much better if it is in Gujarati, business language. Mm. Then Prabhupada said, yes, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so much advice, but
no,
you are
busy
getting your daughters
married. Mm-hmm. Well, like you said, they say, Swamiji, what can we do for you?
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, just give me one of your sons. You know, give me one son, and not one of them would give.
There was
in India.
Yeah, there was one thing happened once in Hyderabad. Now they have a temple, of course, in Hyderabad, but I was with Prabhupada there in 73, and I remember. It was so funny, these group of about four men, Indian men, they came in and they were talking with Prabhupada, and they said, Prabhupada, please give us your blessings to build a temple. You know, we want to build a temple for you. And Prabhupada said, if you want to build a temple, he said, it's okay. He said, you can do that. And they said, no, but we want your blessings. And Prabhupada just would not do it. And he kept on saying, if you want to do a temple, he said, you want to build a temple. He said, it's very good. He said, you build a temple. And then they would say again, but please, you give us your blessings. And Prabhupada just would not do it. He just kept saying, it's okay, you want to do a temple. He said, you build a temple. Okay. So he just wouldn't, because he knew. You know, and I didn't know, but I could see there was a definite reason that Prabhupada didn't want to cooperate with these people in their project. You know. And they kept saying, you tell us to do it. And he said, if you want to do it, do it. He said, but I'm not telling you to do it.
He even refused money from people who wanted plaques put up or things like this.